centimeters or 10 meters or up to 1.2 gigahertz in any of those bands, that basically if you were at the same number of elements with different frequencies, they would be scaling as the equivalent. And the reason why I would suspect that that's the case, but I guess the reason why I always ask the question is because in the back of my mind, when you look at all the different designs at different frequencies, the antennas look so different. It almost looks like they don't follow the same rules when they go from one band to the other. But Dick, I'm going to pass it back to K2R, just to keep doing this.
And 2X.
Yeah.
You've fallen into a trap, Glenn. Lots of people for a lot of years have said that when you make the PDIT longer, it becomes a high Q narrowband structure. Everyone used to believe that. Not necessarily true. Gunter Haas discovered that when you use his particular design procedure, you come up with a Yagi that has near optimum performance, but a tiny bit below optimum performance, but it's a very forgiving design. Forgiving design has got three meanings. That means the accuracy with which you build the length of each element is a little bit more forgiving. The spacing between the elements is a little bit more forgiving. And the bandwidth is a lot more than you would think. You would think that if you had a 10-element Yagi on 432 and it was 10 megacycles wide, and you went from 10 elements to 20 elements, that the 10 megacycles wide may go to 5 megacycles wide. Absolutely not. It becomes a little bit more narrow, but nowhere near that fast. So just because a guy has made a long Yagi, you think it's going to be high in Q and narrow band, depending on the design procedure he used, maybe yes and maybe no. If it's a Gunter Haas procedure, no. There's a little bit of less bandwidth when you make it longer, but it doesn't get more narrow anywhere near as fast as you think it would. Now, scalability. When it comes to every antenna that you build with passive components, what we got? If I had a real good Yagi design of, let me pick a number, 9 elements on 6 meters, and I wanted a 9-element Yagi on 432, if I scaled the diameter, the spacing, the length, if I scaled every single dimension of the antenna, proportional to the wavelength, I'll get the exact same gain, the exact same pattern, the exact same standing wave ratio, the exact same beam width, bandwidth, call it what you like. Antennas are thoroughly scalable. Passive antennas, as long as you've scaled every single dimension, they scale. So therefore, if somebody had a real good Yagi design on 6 meters, and you make an equivalent on 432, you've got the exact same antenna. With that philosophy, Dr. Haas, DL6WU, has taken everybody's Yagi design, no matter what frequency it's on, no matter what number of elements or whatever, essentially every one of those Yagi, he has scaled it to 432, his favorite frequency, put it in that anechoic chamber, and made measurements. And now he's got a whole bunch of graphs as to, you can find a Dr. Haas graph if you go to the right article in the German magazine, among other places, or you just Google the word DL6WU and look at all of his articles that you can Google, you'll eventually find one of his graphs where he's got number of wavelengths horizontal, decimals of gain vertical, and there's a graph of what kind of gain you should be getting, and you see a whole lot of dots on that graph. Each one of those dots has somebody's call letters alongside of it. Let me drop. Each one of those dots has got somebody's call letters alongside of it because that's that particular guy's design. And therefore, you can look at the scatter plot of how close all of those individual designs fall to the so-called Gunter Haas ideal curve. He calls it a middle curve, which I think means middle performance in German. Anyhow, you look at that curve and you can find out how effective are all of those designs that are around the world. And you look at this full graph, I'm guessing it's got 25 or 30 dots on it, with 25 or 30 different call letters of all those individual designs. What are some of the information you're looking for, Glenn? It's QQIQ, it's from Deep, it's RIW.
Yeah,
this
is very good, Dick. That's exactly what I anticipated. It's both my experience everything I've been reading about bad Yagi movies. I definitely researched one of Gunther Hahn's articles. Very good stuff. And, but it still leads me to the second half of the question, which is, yeah, I think as we've all kind of realized by doing the measurements and checking them out, that, yeah, the antennas really are scalable. But which leads us to the next question. Why do you think all the manufacturers make their antennas so different when they go to different bands? As a matter of fact, like you're saying, when you compare a lot of these manufacturers' antennas to some of the data that Gunther Hawk has done and some of the other, you know, more theoretical designs, when you start comparing them, it's like all these Yankees are like completely different as they come out of the box. You can spend hours and hours and hours fiddling with these things, trying to make improvements on them. And there's always something, some adjustment to make on these antennas when they come out of the box. It's like the worst advice I ever would give somebody is, if you're looking for a high performance jack, take it right out of the box now and do a quick tune and put it up in the air. Because usually you're sacrificing a tremendous amount of performance. I'm just wondering if you agree with any of that. Dick. Hey, Tori, I just need you to do it here. This is the best of all worlds, Glenn. A guy who got real interested in Yankees, fiddled with them, did a whole lot of research, looked at everybody else's design worldwide, compared them to whatever, and he decided, yep, this is the design procedure that's right for me, this is the mechanical method of setting up an antenna that's right for me, and I'm going to open up an antenna company. I'm the president of the company, and I'm going to build the antenna with that philosophy, with that design, with that physical layout. You'd like to believe it that way. Well, not likely. More likely, a guy decides that, hey, I'm building these things, and as a sideline, I'm going to also start manufacturing some antennas for ham radio operators or for the commercial world. I don't know anything about antennas, but I'm going to go choose some so-called antenna maze that I can find, and they're rare, but you don't know that. And the best way I can prove that one to you, by the way, is that arguably the most progressive company that I know of on Long Island in the 1980 time frame was Airborne Instruments Laboratory, where I worked for 35 years. Okay. At the height of their success, in the middle of the B-1B program, they had 1,200 degree, mostly electronic engineers working for the company. Some of them were mechanical, but most of them electronic. 1,200 degree engineers. The antenna department had something like 15 employees. By my standards, 8 or so of those employees had a good working understanding of the antennas. So here's a company where every single product they make has got radio need, because it's primarily radar jammers, radar receivers, radar exciters, radar rotary joints, and whatever, antennas.
Repeater, time out.
Everything that company made had something to do with radio. They needed antenna design work, because all those radios don't work without antennas. Out of 1,200 carefully selected degree engineers, approximately 10 of them had a good working knowledge of antennas. That is 1% of the carefully selected people. You talk to any guy coming out of electrical engineering school where his emphasis is on wireless communication techniques, and you start asking him antenna questions, you rapidly discover that the way he was taught didn't stick. He didn't get it. He doesn't have it. It's a rare art in science. As such, you and I are opening up a company. We want to start designing antennas. We go out and try to buy, select, get, borrow, steal an antenna engineer who's going to be our chief engineer for the design we're about to manufacture. They're rare as hen's teeth. The good ones almost don't exist, if you know what I mean. So, therefore, by some mysterious process, you come up with a design which you think is good enough, it's economic enough, it looks pretty enough, people will buy it, and you go out and build it. That gives you a little bit of an idea as to why, in theory, somewhere there's an optimum design for Yagi antennas. Dr. Hack is certainly one of the best ones to start off with, and you'd like to believe that all the antennas out there are being manufactured by that procedure. You're slowly discovering why that ain't that way. KC2QIQ, K2LAW.
Yeah, I kind of follow exactly what you're saying. I've seen it. it is interesting. And you'd think that it would go that way, but like you're saying, there's just so many variables in the manufacturer of antennas. And it always seems to be like the last thought at the end. Oh, yeah, that's right. Now we've got to work on the antenna. Always a pleasure, Dick. Great hearing you in there. And please introduce me. Keep to worry about these cases like this.
We know, Dick, for the comment. When you look at major programs to do a research and development of a product that's eventually going to be manufactured, particularly when there is a nearly infinite supply of money in some people's mind, a military project, you're building something like one of the boxes that goes into the B-1B bomber, there's 105 of them, and you talk about the design of that particular box. That particular box, somebody at the beginning of the program has come up with the criteria the box must be. How big, how heavy, how many watts going in, what kind of signal goes in, what kind of signal goes out. You got all these defined things. And so the engineers start to scratching their heads, start making diagrams and paper. In those days, they were moving the slide rule, eventually they were moving electronic calculators, and they're coming up with a design. So 80% of the way through research and development for that particular design, most of the design is complete. You got a couple of cubic inches left over somewhere in the box, and somebody says, oh, we're going to put the power supply there. And the power supply usually is an afterthought, or the antenna is another afterthought. For reasons that are mysterious to me, power supplies are considered, run-of-the-mill, they're not highly reliable power supplies. There's a lot of design procedures that goes into that to make it self-sustaining, self-protecting, high in performance, low in ripple, high in efficiency. And so that should be in the beginning of the design because the rest of the box can be gold-plated, everything's perfect. Without a reliable power supply, you've got nothing. And so many projects end up with a tiny bit of space left over and somebody wants a kilowatt high-efficiency power supply to squeeze in there. And antennas come out that way also. When it comes to handheld products, like cell phones and cordless phones and whatever, the design procedure there, nowhere near enough emphasis is given to the antenna
repeater. Timeout.
Nowhere near enough emphasis given on the antenna, and a tiny little space is left over. And in the early days, people were smart enough to put a real whip antenna sticking out of the top of the rig that you would pull up when you wanted to make a cell phone. And they soon realized that most people didn't even bother pulling up the antenna. And eventually the public said, I don't want the antenna to show anywhere. Squeeze it inside. And you're making sacrifices as you do all this. As you hide the antenna deeper and deeper inside the electronics, the performance of the antenna becomes lower and lower in bandwidth. Doesn't become necessarily lower and lower in radiating efficiency, as long as you've used the right materials for the antenna. Use the right materials for the antenna that are lossless, and everything else nearby that was lossy is in shielded cans, and that you can make the antenna still have 99% radiation efficiency, but as you squeeze it down and shield it with all this other jazz around it, the Q goes up, the bandwidth goes down, and as such, essentially every single antenna and every cell phone these days is not simply an antenna. It's an antenna with a tuning network connected to it. There's an antenna tuner in a small little package on almost every one of those antennas because we force them to be squeezed down that way. And now you worry about the insertion loss and efficiency of the antenna tuner and how fast it can hop from one fan to another. That's another whole detail. So these important structures, because so few people have a real understanding of what wireless communication is really like, and that requires a darn good high-performance antenna to work well. And because there's so few people with that knowledge, and also a few people that have got enough power to control the program early enough, the antenna is not giving enough emphasis. That's a bunch of opinions. I've watched it happen. KQIIW, listening.
Copy me, Dick. Yes, no, and two echolotters.
Okay. I know that was only the first of your articles in the mailbags. Yes, we went way left of center, way right of center, but hopefully some of that is information that will be helpful to your guy named Jim, who wrote in with that question.
John, on top of that, the missing information from last week's TechNet looks like it is on the way to being available to people. Go on with the next one, John. KC2WGB, KQLIW for TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, by the way, Roy told me that download was about 250 megabytes, so it wasn't as much as we thought, and then he sent that on. Okay, and by the way, Rich, you are being heard, but you just came in through, so there's no sense in coming over to you. All right, my next question is, as Mel, KUI, would like to simplify things, if we look at a basic element gag, can we consider the reflector element to be basically almost a one-way mirror, and the parasitic directors, or directors on one, as a one-way, as a two-way mirror? To vision that, it seems to be a little easier for me, and maybe for other people. Would that be a correct, simple analysis?
I wish the answer was yes, and I think the answer is no. First of all, John, I'm going to let you in on a dirty little secret. There is no such thing as a one-way mirror until you start getting into some very exotic materials. If I made a partially silvered mirror where the silvering is thin enough that some of the signal flows through, so that when I stand in front of that mirror, I will see my reflection. As long as the room behind the mirror is dark enough, I'll think I'm looking at a mirror. If I'm looking at a mirror that's giving 90% reflection instead of 100% reflection, and if the room behind the mirror is dark enough, you probably will not know the difference. Now you put people in that darkened room with dark adapted eyes, and although they're only seeing 10% of the light that flows through the mirror, they are watching what's going on in front of that mirror. You can call that a one-way mirror if you like. The amount of signal flowing through is 10%, whether it flows from left to right or right to left. You make bright enough light in that so-called dark room with the people who are observing what's going on, and now you go into the other room, you will dimly see those people alongside of your reflection. You'll suddenly realize that, hey, that's not a thoroughly illuminated mirror. There is no such thing as a one-way mirror. It becomes a one-way mirror when you set it up just right. You think it's one way. It's not. Okay. That reflector, is it a one-way mirror? It is a interferometry device. In other words, it absorbs and re-radiates. It absorbs and re-radiates with a phase shift, so that the signal coming off of the re-radiated reflector and the signal coming off the dipole in the real direction, they happen to be 180 degrees out of phase, and they cancel. Does a real mirror cancel like that? No, it doesn't. Does a real mirror have one way? No, it doesn't. In the case of the director, the signal coming off the dipole in the forward direction, the signal being re-radiated after it was absorbed and re-radiated.
Repeater, time out.
The signal being re-radiated by the director in the forward direction, those two signals are in phase with each other. So, the best way to look at it, as I see it, for a three-element YAG, is interferometry. As long as you can understand what happens when two signals are out of phase and two signals are in phase, and Mother Nature takes all signals and adds them, not in power, she adds them in voltage. You and I think in power because we measure power with our Bird Model 432 watt meter. That's a Bird, I meant a Hewlett Packard watt meter. But we measure power. Mother Nature really looks at voltages. When it comes to signals coming into a receiving antenna that are coming from five directions at once because of multipath, you take the voltage of each one of those paths and the phase angle of each one of those paths and add those voltages together in a vector manner. That really means you're doing a polar diagram, if you know what I mean, in voltage, and that's what the resultant will be. That three-element antenna is adding voltages in one direction and canceling voltages in the other direction. I believe that's closer to the truth, John. KC2WGB, KQLIW.
KC2WGB, Very good, Dick. Okay. I think that just about covers Yankee. That was a lot of information. It just goes to show you how much information is required about antennas and the understanding of it. All right. I'm going to drop and I'll go on to the next question. Then we'll go to Paul. All right, Dick, I have a question. Here we go with WaveBat. All right. I have done that. That's a nice idea, Dick. He's worried about flexible waveguides working because after hearing your description of how the magnetic wave and each wave travels now, the waveguide, if you have flexible waveguide, which is like a bellow system, and you can bend it, you look at it, it looks like an accordion. How does that internal structure reflect the wave in the way you suggested when all of those structures are not regular inside that waveguide? So that's basically his question. Maybe you could give him a rundown on how that works.
Yeah, the way I describe the waveguide is a little bit similar to that barber shop where you've got mirrors on the forward wall, mirrors on the back wall, and you look at a 45-degree angle down the length of that barber shop compared to the axis of it, and you'll see the last barber chair two or three times in a row. The signal's really zigzagging back and forth, and waveguide definitely zigzags back and forth. We call the signal TE or TM, meaning that the electric wave is always at right angles to the direction of propagation or the magnetic wave. However, the real wave going down the waveguide is always TEM. That wave doesn't know it's in a waveguide. That waveguide, that real signal thinks it's in free space. The only thing, if the wave is smart enough, it may realize that it's bouncing off of two vertical walls. When the waveguide is laying on the table with the broad wall flat to the table, the vertical walls are where the signal is bouncing back and forth, left and right. And yes, it is bouncing at a very exact angle off those walls and propagating down. And you'd like to believe the walls have to be mirror smooth. Well, mirror smooth compared to wavelength. If you and I were grinding a mirror, let me drop it. We're grinding a mirror for a Newtonian telescope, you're making a parabolic mirror. How accurate does the mirror have to be? The mirror that's in your bathroom is accurate enough for what you're doing when you stand in front of it, you're shaving, and you're putting on your makeup, and you're combing your hair. But if you really study that mirror has bumps and grinds in its surface because that was not optically flat glass that received the luminization, luminizing. And the luminizing itself is not done in an optical coherent manner. When you really make a high-performance parabolic mirror for a telescope, you want the surface of the mirror to be flat to the nearest 20th of a wavelength. Okay, your eye is operating at 555 nanometers approximately. A 20th of a wavelength is, around 120 nanometers. It's around a micro-inch. You want the mirror flat to the nearest micro-inch. And the aluminizing you put on top of it has to be very precisely done so that it doesn't have bumps and grinds, and it's super smooth. And you're doing it by an optical deposition process that's very carefully done. You get full performance in optical flat. And when you do that correctly, you end up with a telescope that's called diffraction limited. Okay? So, flat, how smooth does something have to be to do the job? Obviously, that mirror in your bathroom is probably 1,000 times rougher than the parabolic mirror you're trying for your telescope. And for that particular purpose, 1,000 times rougher is good enough. However, if you have a big enough mirror on your wall of your living room or your bathroom, and you back away from it at a long distance, and you look at it with binoculars, and you look at the reflection, you'll say, wow, what a distance. At a long enough distance, it'll look like the funhouse mirror in an amusement park, if you know what I mean. As you get a longer and longer distance away, the signal that reflects off of those individual portions of the mirror that are not flat enough
because of the way the angles add up at a longer distance, you'll start seeing roughness. You'll start seeing a distorted picture. And if you want that mirror in your bathroom to pass that test, where you can be a long distance away from it, look at it with a pair of binoculars, and still get a clean picture, it now has to be a 20th of a wavelength flat. Okay? The signal reflecting off the walls of that waveguide, even though that is corrugated like an accordion pleating, because the corrugations are, let me pick a number, a 10th or a 20th of a wavelength, the signal going down there almost doesn't know the distance. Almost. Now, if you make careful measurement of the insertion loss of flexible waveguide versus silver-plated, nitrogen, dry nitrogen-filled flat waveguide, yes, the insertion loss will be different. You're getting some extra loss from the accordion pleating. But the accordion pleating, by definition, let me drop it, is quite small compared to a wavelength. The next thing that will amaze you is that you would think the waveguide better have exactly parallel walls, left wall and right wall, better be perpendicular to the broad wall at exactly a 90 degree angle, and they better be parallel to each other. And if it's huge and in your way, you would assume the waveguide stops working. Okay? Go to the next step. And you start building a waveguide at 10 gigahertz for the handband at 10.368. And you use 3/4 inch copper water pipe that you buy at a Home Depot. Round pipe. The signal is zigzagging back and forth the exact same way. And it's not zigzagging off of a vertical flat wall. It's zigzagging off of a heavily curved wall. And how does it still do that? Again, you look at the curvature compared to wavelength, and the signal manages to even it all out. There's a catch, though. All waveguide has got dispersion. In other words, because at each individual frequency, there's an exact angle of bounce where all the phases add up correctly after multiple bounces. When you go down the waveguide a few wavelengths, only an exact angle at which it bounces, and that angle becomes closer and closer to being parallel with the major axis of the waveguide as you go to higher frequencies. As such, all waveguides have got what's called dispersion. That means that the signal at the higher frequency gets there first. So if you've got a whole lot of wavelengths of your waveguide, if you try to run waveguide 1,000 feet, unless you're doing it at one very narrow frequency, you're probably in a lot of trouble. Because the higher frequencies are going to get there a lot faster than the lower frequency. And the problem gets worse as the wavelength gets longer. As the number of wavelengths of waveguides, or the number of feet, or the number of meters of waveguide goes up, the dispersion effect is a function of length, because it's a proportional characteristic on each and every bounce. They start adding up. Now, these are rectangular waveguides. The dominant mode is called TE10. That means that there is one change per dimension. In other words, a signal, if I've got vertically polarized signal going into a piece of waveguide where the broad wall is flat on the table, that vertically polarized signal is zigzagging back and forth. If I now plot the signal strength versus position across the face of the waveguide, the open end is looking at me, I discovered that I've got maximum E field between the upper broad wall and the lower broad wall. I've got a vertical arrow, maximum strength in the center. The signal gets weaker and weaker until I get over to the far left-hand edge where it goes to zero. At the far right-hand edge, it goes to zero. If I plot that signal strength versus position, it is a half sine wave. You know what a sine wave looks like on a oscilloscope of a wave coming out of a quick signal generator. And if I fully rectify it and just look at one of those rectified cycles, that wave shape, it's called a sine wave, is exactly the voltage versus position you get in a rectangular piece of waveguide. Longer signal repeater.
Time out.
Stronger signal in center, and it goes to zero at the edges. Okay, that's called TE10, because there is one variation in signal strength from left to right in that dimension, but there is no variation in signal strength from top to bottom. So if I choose a particular position and I look at the signal strength at the bottom versus the top, it's the same, if you know what I mean, at one particular horizontal position. So there is no variation vertically, but there is one cycle of, one half cycle of variation horizontally. That's the reason why it's called TE10, TE10. Transverse electric, meaning that at every point along the waveguide, the electric signal is perpendicular to the direction of propagation. But because the signal is weak, zigzagging back and forth, left and right, the H field, which is horizontal, is a little bit tilted compared to the axis of the waveguide. So it is not transverse magnetic, it's only transverse electric. Okay. Rectangular waveguide uses nomenclature like that. Let me drop. The signal is flowing down that round piece of copper pipe at 10 gigahertz. It's called TE11 circular. Okay. What do those numbers mean? Because the way they set up the axis for definition on round waveguide versus rectangular waveguide is a different way of setting up the axis, and it's a slightly different definition, they call it TE11 circular. So what you're talking about, circular waveguide versus rectangular. And when you write down the TE11, you put a little circle as a superscript in the upper right-hand corner of the TE to let people know it's electric. It's round waveguide you're talking about, and that's rectangular waveguide. And therefore, the 1-1 has some meaning. It is possible with rectangular waveguide, when you're using it at higher than normal frequencies, let me drop. It is possible in rectangular waveguide to create a wave that's called TE11 rectangular. So to avoid the rampant ambiguity, if you're talking about circular, you put that little circle alongside of the TE. Okay. Now, here's the experiment that I and the guys in the 10X group, 10X means 10 gigahertz and X band, and so there used to be a telephone company called 9X. And we made a joke out of it. We called ourselves the 10X Club on Long Island. A group of guys who just love 10 gigs. We would get together, and one of the experiments that we did is that we took a round piece of copper tubing, and by way of shoving mandrels down there, chunks of steel that were cut just right, we were able to slowly shape the round piece of waveguide where it was round at one end, and it came out to be a perfectly rectangular piece of WR90 waveguide at the other end. And a piece of copper structure was about 8 inches long. So in an 8-inch length, I had round waveguide at one end and rectangular waveguide at the other end. And you send the signal down there, and you say, what's going to happen? Yep. You expected all hell to break loose. You expect the signal that when it's bouncing just right in round waveguide and it's bouncing just right in a rectangular waveguide, you would assume those two bounces don't properly mix together. It's the exact same wave. It started with the signal in the rectangular guide. It comes through the structure that I just described to you. It comes out of the round end. And now you plug it into a round piece of waveguide. You make measurements. You realize you have no standing wave ratio, per se. I think we had a 30 dB reflection coefficient. As long as we made the taper gradual enough. And you soon realize a TE10 signal in rectangular and a TE11 signal in round is the exact same signal. Bouncing the exact same way. As long as you make the transition slow enough, nothing bad happens. Did you make a transition from one mode to the other? No, it's the exact same mode. Ain't that crazy? The books don't tell you that. We did it, and it worked like a charm. The only thing different when you have to launch the signal is the round waveguide. And now with the round waveguide, it's got a little bit of run out to it, and it's a slightly elliptical shape. The horizontal signal, the vertically polarized signal you launch into it, after some number of feet around waveguide, it may slowly rotate itself to horizontal. So you might have to put septums in there to force the polarization to be the way you want it to be. Periodically, you put septums in there, a vertical piece of pipe, a vertical piece of sheet metal that's parallel to the axis of propagation. Okay, so there's one of the peculiar characteristics of waveguide. Round waveguide and rectangular waveguide are really transmitting the exact same kind of wave. And so now, how in the world can the signal bounce off a beautiful smooth piece of waveguide, bounce off an accordion pleated piece of flexible waveguide, bounce off the sides of a round piece of waveguide, and it's the exact same signal doing the exact same thing? as long as the bumps and grinds are small compared to wavelength. Repeater, time out. As long as the bumps and grinds are small compared to wavelength, they're almost not there. It's not an optical situation. If your eyes operated at 80 meter ham band, 3.5 megahertz, and you looked at the grass in your backyard, you would think it's a perfectly smooth mirror. 80 meters of wavelength is a wavelength of roughly 250 feet. 250 foot wavelength, but looking at the grass in your backyard, where the individual blades of grass are, let me pick a number, 3 inches high, and each individual blade is a quarter of an inch or eighth of an inch wide, those fine details cannot be resolved when you're looking at it with a wavelength of 250 feet. Those are fine details. It would look like a perfect mirror. That 80 meter dipole you've got in your backyard, it thinks it's above a perfect mirror, which is the dirt in your backyard that's below it, and it thinks that mirror is only partially silver, because some of the 80 meter wave penetrates the ground, and the ground is a volumetric resistant material, and some of the signal penetrates and gets absorbed. So it is what you and I were talking about earlier, John, as a one-way mirror, which really means partially silver mirror, and it's dark on the far side. The dirt underneath is dark, if you know what I mean. There's no light, there's no room under there with a bright light in there, so to speak. So that 80 meter dipole in your backyard thinks it's looking at a one-way mirror when it's looking at the reflection, and it thinks the mirror is extremely smooth. KC2WGB, K2RIW. It's a matter of how you look at it, John.
KC2WGB. Beautiful explanation. That was clear. Because I think that was a very good question. I don't think too many people do it. If you look at that corrugated dipole, see how could that reflection maintain that perfect position? And that's why I thought that was an excellent question. And great answer. And now it's understood. And I'm sure they could go for a little more research if they wanted to, but I think that's sufficient. And that transition from round waveguide to rectangular waveguide, and being that you maintain that transition over a long length of time, that's the same as tapering the collateral cable system that you were talking about, to maintain your beat, sort of change your beat, and have it all work together correctly. Okay, very good. Well, made up a lot of time on those two questions, but beautiful answers. All right, we'll go over to Paul, and that's it from the mailbag. KC2WGB.
Julio, Dick, do you copy me on the input, over? Yes, no.
So, Paul, what has NASA been doing so far this week? That's WS2N, K2RIW. And once again, you got to tell me how many astronomical units is Voyager out there. I know the answer, but it's fun to hear about it. WS2N, K2RIW. That's great, Paul.
Okay, this is WS2N. And now what, for 128 for Voyager 1? 105, I think, yeah, for Voyager 2. That's a witness on that. I don't go by the Earth's security. You find out it's going backwards sometimes. So I just like to do it from the from the sun. I go to time. And last time I looked, it was over 35 hours round trip for Voyager 1. NASA's, well, a lot of cancellations with NASA and SpaceX and all those science lately is one of those things. For instance, tonight at 8 o'clock, you know, that would have been like breaking news to me, you know, it was supposed to be a launch by SpaceX tonight down in Florida, but it's been called off. Not because of them, but the satellites on board. There's half a dozen satellites that they're going to launch on a 6-degree inclination. And one of the satellites is giving a bad response. They want to look into that before they launch. But the next opportunity would be a couple of days away, not tomorrow. And right now there's some maintenance planned for the area for the next 2 weeks. So my guess, maybe the end of the month or in July, we'll drop it. And that's the one that's got WorldCom 2 on it. WorldCom 2 is half a dozen satellites, eventually going to be 17 satellites, all launched by SpaceX, you know, over the next year or two. Satellites to have mostly machine-to-machine communications, you know, trucks to where they're located to something else, boats, ships, M2M, they call machine-to-machine communication. And there's voice and other stuff on it as well, but they're manufactured really by Orbital Science, the other company that has a contract with NASA. They have a Cygnus cargo vehicle to go to the International Space Station. One coming up beginning of July. And but they may make satellites and things. I mean, in fact, they've got something before. They'll make a satellite for a company, and it turns out SpaceX launches it for them. So commercial guys are really involved in dropping. So I'm waiting for the results from Orbital Science to come back. They were supposed to launch this month as well, but they've been put off because one of their test rockets in the Senate, you know, they used the NASA facility to test rockets, and one of the future rockets that would be launched to the space station was being tested there. Next year was planned on going up, and the rocket completely failed, major problem, and this happened in, end of May, and they've been looking into it ever since. Because of it, they've canceled the present flight, and they don't want a mishap, and they want to find out what the problem is before they go ahead. So, there's delays there with Orbital Science. There's a delay with, like I said, with SpaceX tonight. It was supposed to go up, and SpaceX, they've canceled it there about three or four times. One time, again, not because of that, because of a radar problem downrange, and there wasn't more. One other cancellation, actually, by NASA. WSON. One that we've talked about quite a bit, which was the LDSD, the Low Density Supersonic Accelerator, planned by NASA to, it's not an orbital mission, it's a type of mission. And if anybody was listening in the last couple of weeks, this flying saucer was gadget with a rocket in the middle of it. And the idea is to test large payloads that would be eventually landing on Mars, for instance. Right now they use roughly 15 to 16 foot, probably a little smaller, probably around 14, 15 foot diameter heat shield, and whatever payload they can put behind it, Curiosity maybe, or the other rovers. Spirit or Opportunity, they've all come in on these things. But eventually they want to put bigger, heavier payloads to Mars, robotic missions, bigger ones, or human missions. And they need to increase the diameter of these vehicles that would be coming in through the Martian atmosphere. Martian atmosphere is about less than 1% of our density here on Earth. So they need to test that as they need to go to an area that has that atmosphere. find a rarefied atmosphere like that on Earth, you have to go up high, way up high. So they plan on launching this balloon, which would get eventually as big as a stadium, to bring this heavy craft up to, you know, like 23 miles up. And they plan on dropping it at that point, and a rocket behind it would take, you know, take it to a Mach 4, you know, four times the speed of sound. And then at that point, this thing would open up to a, you know, like a big airbag, blow up to increase the size about 20, a little over 20 feet in diameter. And that would have to help slow it down. And after that, a 100 plus foot parachute would open up. That's twice as big of anything that they've landed on Mars. And they need to run this test. Felt the best place to do it wasn't Hawaii. The Air Force, they've got a missile launch facility down there, one of the islands. And what happens is they've looked all over the world for the best place to do this, and this one has the best trade winds and all the different, you know, components for a launch. They've been trying this all month long, but the winds have not been right. And like this, you know, listen to the news, and, you know, it's funny. You watch, they'll talk to each other, and one guy will say, well, what about Mars? You know, you're not going to have that opportunity. If the wind's not right, you're coming in, you only got one shot deal. But they don't completely pay attention to what's going on. And it's not a question of, you know, they need the wind to go one way or the other in a Martian atmosphere. They need it on Earth because we live in a populated area, and Hawaii is one of them. So if you launch this balloon, go up 23 miles high, and the winds happen to be going the wrong way, and for some reason that balloon fails, you're going to have this, you know, probably about a 3 or 4 ton craft crashing down into somebody's backyard, you know, 20 miles below. They can't have that. And the winds, every time they went up, and, well, you know, they ran tests the last couple of years. It's always been good in Hawaii. It's always gone. The winds have always been going out over the Pacific, but not this whole month. Nothing but trouble, and now they have some delays because this other launch of Pacific things have to go on down in Hawaii, so they might not get another chance. So maybe end of this month or beginning of next month. So we'll see. Well, not delayed more than that. Other people use these facilities to drop it. So I just want to talk about that, and hope they get that going. So it's three things I've been looking forward to that just are not happening. One thing that is happening is private company Colorado has taken over this spacecraft that was launched 36 years ago around the sun. It's done common hunting work and this and that over the years, over decades. But for the last maybe 15 years, it's been shut down by NASA. But it has plenty of fuel on board. And this private company requested and got permission to utilize this. They want to put it into a different orbit. Actually, they want to put it into an L1 orbit, Lagrange point 1, transfer from this solar orbit that it's in. And it's called the ISEE-3. It's International Sun Earth Explorer 3. They want to use it for science. And these guys got permission to do it. They made contact with it. They were using Arecibo. Must have loved them because a couple of the guys are hams. Both guys called. I don't know how many here, but one guy in charge is a ham. They must be having a blast down in Puerto Rico, and eventually they're going to be operating out of, you know, their facility, whatever they got in Colorado to operate the spacecraft. And they've contacted it. They found out all the equipment on board is still working. Still has a bunch of fuel on board. And they hope to start the engine shortly. And they have to do this soon. They can't like wait a month or two. Because the thing is still in orbit.
Stand by a second, Paul. Eric, KE2EJ, I just noticed that the Eastern Machine 147.375 is not repeating our signal. Is that because of a timeout or something that should be reset? KE2EJ, KE2LAW. Okay, maybe Paul's not available right now. Hopefully he heard that. So.
That's probably what happened to Cook. You let it reset. Give it a minute.
All right, let's do a thorough reset and see what happens.
No, I think they should have reset it. I'm at the end of the three or four different topics I wanted to cover anyway, but that's pretty much it. If you have any questions or anybody else, ask now or... Actually, you can go to on email space report spacenetreport at gmail.com. You can also find that on the limartech.com website. I also have one article there that I did put in there. Another one to follow maybe in about a week or so. Click on space. That website. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, TechNet, WS.
Pretty fine, Paul. And John, you were right. When we let it completely drop and come back up, the Eastern Machine is running again. I know some guys out there can only get the Eastern Machine. So they were being denied some of the information. And whether or not there is a connection to the Echo Link, I'm not sure. I'm a little bit worried that when the Eastern Machine is in its non-transmitting mode, I'm wondering if there was a correlation between that and the Echo Link people also being blocked out. Do you happen to know that one, though? Since you're monitoring Echo Link, you probably know. KC2WGB, KQLAW.
Yes, Nick, as far as I can tell, Echo Link was still up because the population index was still moving. So we did have audio on Echo Link.
Okay, glad to hear it. You guys have heard my talk about waveguides. And when waveguides have to be exactly a half wavelength wide or wider for the signal to go down there at all, that's the so-called dominant mode. If you're willing to make the waveguide half wavelength wide, vertically and full wavelength wise horizontally, then there's more mode. There's more than one way the signal can bounce down there and end up at the end. And the reason why people avoid that is because if you don't do it exactly right, the two different signals bouncing two different ways, the exact same signal bouncing two different ways, at certain positions along the guide comes out in phase and out of phase, and therefore when you sweep it in frequency, you end up with a scalloped shaped pattern of insertion loss versus frequency. And in many situations, that's undesirable. There is a special kind of waveguide called tall guide, where you intentionally make the vertical dimension, you make the horizontal dimension a little bit more than halfway, you make the vertical dimension multiple halfways, and therefore, the signal zigzags back and forth to the left and the right, it now bounces off a very large vertical wall. The insertion loss becomes much, much lower if you're careful enough not to avoid the higher mode. A tall guide is a very desirable kind of waveguide if you want very low loss, as long as you're careful enough to use it correctly. But now this relates to the parachute that the poles are talking about. Let me show you what I mean by that. If you have a small parachute and if you design it correctly, making it stable is relatively easy. As the parachute becomes larger and larger, the possibility exists that the air entering the parachute enters in more than one way and bounces around in funny ways. If the parachute becomes very large, keeping it stable becomes very difficult. I remember seeing a YouTube video this week where somebody was flying one of these, what would you call it now? Not flying wing. It's a wing-shaped parachute. But he was flying an extremely large one. And you could watch it periodically fold up as the sky was descending. So an extremely large parachute. There's more than one way that the air can bounce inside and therefore occasionally become unstable, swing back and forth, partially fold up, completely fold up. And so I think one of the reasons why NASA is doing this experiment with this flying saucer-shaped kind of a parachute we dropped. Is that you stand a greater chance for this larger drove device to slow you down when you enter the atmosphere of Mars. This very large device, you stand a much better chance of keeping it stable because it's not inflating in the normal parachute manner. You don't get quite as much bang for the dollar. The round device is going to give you a little bit less drag than a parachute of that diameter would. But there's a chance of, there's a much bigger chance if you design it correctly and suspend it correctly of keeping that large device stable as you're doing the descent. In fact, you not have the parachute swing back and forth. And then, you know, Don Well, Murphy's Law will dictate that it will be in a great big swing as you hit the ground. And that's sort of what happened on the failure of the B-1B bomber. Oh, I think that occurred around 1990. They were doing a maneuver close to the ground where the aircraft went into a failure mode. They went into the protection mode where, in those days, the whole module that included pilot and co-pilot and the four officers were all in a module, and the whole module got ejected simultaneously on one very large parachute. But because that ejection took place close to the ground, and the parachute was swinging back and forth and hadn't yet stabilized, it was in a great big swing at the instant it struck the ground, and as such, some of the occupants died, and one of the main test pilots died in that manner. And there's part of the story which I won't go into as to where he was when he died and what he was doing, but safe to say that he wasn't strapped in at the time that it struck the ground. Okay, so I am guessing that stability of larger objects that are saucer-shaped is higher.
Repeater, time out.
I'm guessing that that is easier to achieve. I wonder if any of the information from NASA said something along those lines. Did they give the motivation for building a saucer-shaped object as opposed to a super large parachute form? WS2N into RIW.
Well, they said when they enter the atmosphere, they're coming in, 13,000 miles per hour, a little higher than that, for Mars. And they have a heat shield and all, but they need to increase that diameter. So if they have 15 feet, they need to slow it up to 20 feet. So just try to slow this thing down as much as possible. Try to get it down to, maybe Mach 2.5, 3, they said, and then they could pop out that parachute. Probably, they didn't say it, but I'm assuming there's going to be a drogue parachute, I don't know. But this 105-foot diameter parachute would pop out at that point. So there's two things going on. It's they're testing the craft to see if inflatable bag will increase the surface area roughly 15 to 20 feet, 21 feet. And then soon after that, testing whether or not the parachute is deployed properly. They'll land in the Pacific Ocean and they're going to retrieve it. There is a 26 foot diameter thing planned for manned missions. And they're going to be testing that next year in the same location. And that's the plan. Again, with this 105-foot parachute. The difference between the two sources of traffic, well, they look somewhat the same. One is bigger than the other one. The newer one, the bigger one, instead of just having these like nitro charges go off, and, you know, kind of like a big airbag, to create this sort of look of what they're doing now. The other ones will be will inflate with.